find that Shakespeare's characters sound much more interesting and complex than Richard Nixon's staff. If people in fiction talk the way people do in real life, nobody would read it or believe it. Instead, fictional speech is more focused and coherent than real speech, just as fictional characters are more immediately comprehensible than real people. Even if fictional speech is ungrammatical and rambling, it still has to be ungrammatical and rambling in an interesting and purposeful way. I want to emphasize that second word, purposeful. In real life, sometimes we talk just to pass the time, or because we're nervous, or just to keep from being bored or rude. But in fiction, dialogue has to have a purpose, usually to evoke character, to advance the plot, or to provide exposition. Sometimes it does all three at once. This does not mean that dialogue is purely utilitarian or that it can't be entertaining for its own sake. And the fact that dialogue is purposeful doesn't require that characters always say what they mean. Some of the best dialogue, especially the dialogue that evokes character or the relationship between two characters, can be wonderfully oblique. Sometimes what a character isn't saying is more meaningful than what he or she is saying. I'll talk about that in the next lecture. Meanwhile, in this first lecture about dialogue, I want to talk first, very briefly, about the mechanics of writing dialogue. Then I want to talk about some basic techniques for using dialogue tags, for mixing speech and action, speech and exposition, and so on. Along the way, as painlessly as possible, I'm going to sneak in some actual grammar and punctuation. It's been my experience that even very good writers are sometimes unclear on the actual rules for writing dialogue. Unless you're writing some sort of postmodernist narrative where you're trying to call the reader's attention to the mechanics of the text, you want dialogue to be seamlessly integrated into the rest of the text, and that's more easily accomplished if you have mastered the rules and stick to them. If you glance at a page of fiction from a slight distance, close enough to see the paragraphs but too far away to read the words, it's impossible to tell if the text you're looking at is exposition or action or character description. From a distance, these different sorts of passages all look the same. Action and exposition are differentiated from each other only through context and by internal cues in the text itself. But even from across the room, you can identify a passage of dialogue by the choppy paragraph breaks, and, if you look closer, by the use of quotation marks and some special rules of punctuation. These special rules for dialogue serve two fundamental purposes: to separate direct quotations from the rest of the narrative, and to make it clear for the reader just who is speaking at any given time. The vast majority of fiction published since the 18th century has followed these rules, with some variations. But from time to time, you'll come across some very good writers and some very good books where dialogue is punctuated in a non-standard way. In some books, each line of dialogue is marked with a dash at the beginning of each line instead of by quotation marks. Sometimes dialogue doesn't use quotation marks at all. Instead, it is set off from the rest of the narrative only by a paragraph break. And sometimes, the dialogue isn't even set off by paragraphing. Instead, it's buried right in the middle of a passage, in which case you have to guess that it's dialogue from the context. As I say, there are some very good writers who have written dialogue in an unconventional way. There are long sections of dialogue in William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, for example, that don't use quotation marks, and The Sound and the Fury is one of the greatest American novels ever written. Another great writer who tends not to use quotation marks is Cormac McCarthy, the author of Blood Meridian and The Road. But great writers don't always make good role models. And on the whole, and with very few exceptions, writing dialogue without quotation marks or paragraph breaks is usually pretentious and often annoying. Think of it in terms of a cost-benefit analysis and ask yourself the following question: is what you're gaining by not using standard punctuation for dialogue worth the extra effort you're making for the reader? On the one hand, in the case of The Sound and the Fury, the lack of quotation marks helps evoke the mental disability of the character Benji in the passages that are told from his point of view. On the other hand, even though I yield to no one in my admiration of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, I don't really think that the book would have been diminished if he'd used quotation marks. Most of what you need to know about the mechanics of writing dialogue can be summed up in a few rules. For examples of all these, pick up the nearest work of fiction you have to hand, or at least the nearest one that isn't written by William Faulkner or Cormac McCarthy. Find a few pages that are made up mostly of dialogue. You should be able to find most of the kinds of sentences I'm about to describe. The first rule is that all direct quotations, namely the exact words of a character, should be set apart from the rest of the text by quotation marks. The second rule is that every time a new character speaks or the speaker changes, his or her first line of dialogue should be set apart with a paragraph break. Also, the very beginning of a direct quotation should always begin with a capital letter. Now remember that I said that the rules of punctuation serve two purposes, to set dialogue apart from the rest of the narrative and to identify who is speaking at any given time. The first purpose is served by quotation marks and the paragraph breaks. The second purpose is served by identifying each speaker with something called a dialogue tag. In its most basic form, a dialogue tag is simply the name of the character or a pronoun standing in for the name, plus some variation on the verb said. He said, she said, Bob exclaimed, Elaine whispered, and so on. The rules of punctuating dialogue tags get a little tricky, but I'll lay them out quickly. The first rule is that the dialogue tag is not part of the actual quotation, so it should never be included within the quotation marks. But sometimes a dialogue tag comes in the middle of the quoted sentence. And when that happens, the first half of the quotation is set off by a comma and a quotation mark. The dialogue tag is followed with a comma, and the second half of the sentence begins with a quotation mark and a lowercase letter. However, if a dialogue tag appears between two complete sentences, then the dialogue tag ends with a period, and the second sentence starts with a capital letter. That was quick, and I hope relatively painless. If any of it is confusing, any good grammar guide will explain the rules of punctuating dialogue in more detail than I can here. An even better way to learn them is simply to model what you do after what your favorite writer does, assuming your favorite writer isn't Cormac McCarthy. Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, let's talk about when to use dialogue tags, what sort of dialogue tags you should use, and how to mix dialogue with action and exposition. Unlike the rules of punctuation I just talked about, these are just tips, not rules. None of what I'm about to say is set in stone or is absolute. Other writers or writing teachers might disagree with them, and there are always exceptions and complications. These represent the rules of thumb that I use when I'm writing dialogue, and I think they represent more or less standard practice for most modern fiction writers. The first rule of thumb is that dialogue tags are necessary for three reasons. One, to introduce a character who is speaking for the first time. Two, to identify the speakers when two or more people are speaking. Or three, to get across necessary information or a bit of context that isn't clear from the dialogue itself. Let's take these three reasons one at a time, starting with introducing a character with a dialogue tag. You use a dialogue tag when you're introducing a character for the first time or when you're returning to a character at the beginning of a new chapter or scene. This is the most self-evident use of a dialogue tag. You want to tell the reader who's speaking. But even in this case, there can be exceptions. Say, for example, you open a scene with a single character walking alone into a setting. A woman coming ashore on a desert island after a shipwreck, say. You might write a paragraph or two about her struggling through the surf and struggling onto the beach. Given that she's the only person in sight, the first thing she says, "Is anybody here," for example, or "Thank God I'm alive," would not necessarily need a dialogue tag because she's the only person present. Another instance when you might not need a dialogue tag at the very beginning of a scene would be if you were trying for a dramatic effect like this. "Look out!" The detective turned just in time to see a large guy behind him swinging a baseball bat in his direction. That's a little crude, but you get the idea. The intent of this opening gambit is to immerse the reader right away in a dangerous and suspenseful situation. As a result, you don't need to know immediately who yelled, "Look out!" Though this kind of opening sets up the expectation that the speaker will soon be identified. So perhaps this isn't so much an example of a dialogue without a tag, as it is an example of dialogue with a deferred tag. Let's move to the second reason for deploying dialogue tags. which is to use them when you're writing a scene that has two or more speakers in it. The usual practice in this case is to identify each speaker with his or her first line of dialogue. Again, however, there can be exceptions. And if you've got more than two speakers in a scene, then you're going to have to use more dialogue tags just to keep them straight. Simply identifying the speaker or keeping several speakers straight are the most mechanical uses of dialogue tags. But now we come to the third reason for using dialogue tags, namely to provide some context or nuance that isn't conveyed by the dialogue itself, or to clear up an ambiguity. This use requires more judgment and skill, but it is just as essential. Let's take a very simple example. "I love you," she said. In most cases, the context for this simple but emotional statement is likely to be clear from whatever comes before or after it in the narrative. But it is easy to imagine a number of different ways that statement could be said by the speaker or heard by the character at whom it's directed, not to mention a number of ways it could be understood by the reader. Assuming you don't want the declaration to be ambiguous, there are simple ways of using the dialogue tag to make the statement clear. For example, "I love you," she laughed. "I love you," she sobbed. "I love you," she said casually. Or, instead of altering the dialogue tag, you could italicize one of the words in the dialogue itself to show the speaker's emphasis. Each one of the following versions is subtly different from the others. "I love you," she said. "I love you," she said. "I love you," she said. These examples should make clear that how and when you use a dialogue tag and what sort of dialogue tag you use depends almost entirely on the context of the scene. A little bit later in this lecture, I'll explore that idea in more detail. First, having talked about when dialogue tags are necessary, let's talk about when they're not. My next rule of thumb about dialogue tags is that you should use them sparingly and that you should keep them as simple as possible. How you define sparingly varies from writer to writer, from story to story, and even from scene to scene within a story. But on the whole, the more you can rely on the actual speech of the characters to relay information or convey emotion, the better. In fact, on the whole, you should only use dialogue tags when it would otherwise be impossible to tell who is speaking, or, as I was just saying, when the context needs clarification. But when I say use dialogue tags sparingly, I don't mean too sparingly. On the one hand, you don't want to be obtrusive and redundant, hammering the reader with superfluous he saids or she saids or he sobbed or she whispered. But on the other hand, you don't want the reader to get confused. You want to strike a balance between two goals. On the one hand, you want the character's actual words to carry the weight of the conversation as much as possible. On the other hand, you don't want the reader to lose track of who's saying what. If you have a conversation between two characters that goes on for less than a page, you can probably get away with identifying the speakers at the beginning and then not mentioning them again. Here's an example. "Are you going to Miriam's party?" Mary asked. "I don't know," said Glenn. "I haven't made up my mind." "Oh, for heaven's sake, are you still mad at her?" "I guess, a little." "You're being silly. Get over it." In this case, it's easy not to use too many dialogue tags for two reasons. One is that it is a short exchange. The other is that it's reasonably clear from what the characters are saying just who is speaking at every moment, because one character, Mary, is taking the opposite position from the other character, Glenn. But even if only two people are talking, a dialogue tag is often necessary later in the conversation. This is especially the case if the conversation goes on for a long time and it isn't broken up with a lot of action or exposition. Detective stories, for example, often feature long conversations between an investigator and a suspect or a witness. The investigator asks the suspect a long series of questions and the suspect answers. Some writers introduce the two characters at the start and then dispense with dialogue tags entirely. They're acting on the assumption that it's clear from the dialogue itself who is speaking, simply by virtue of the fact that the detective is usually asking the questions and the other character is usually answering them. And this often works pretty well, especially if the internal cues in each line of dialogue are clear. Sometimes the detective comes from a different social class than the suspect. And in that case, you can tell the difference because the detective speaks in one dialect and the suspect speaks in a different dialect, though the use of dialect raises issues of its own that I'll talk about in the next lecture. But even if the writer is careful to distinguish between the two speakers, sometimes a reader can get confused about just who is saying what, especially during a long exchange. I've certainly had this experience, and I'm sure you have too. There have been times when I've had to go back to the first moment where the speakers were identified and count forward by twos or however many characters there were. In cases like this, it might have helped if the writer had thrown in a dialogue tag every few lines, like a signpost, so we didn't have to keep track on our fingers. Another thing to remember about dialogue tags is that when you do use them, you want to keep them as simple as possible and to avoid over-explaining them. Again, some other writers might say differently, but it's my feeling that you want to avoid verbs that are too descriptive. As I've already said, you want the speech itself to carry as much of the meaning as possible, without unnecessary help from a dialogue tag. In my example about the simple sentence, "I love you," a few moments ago, I suggested that you could clear up the ambiguity of such a statement with a stronger verb than a simple "she said." You might say "she sobbed" instead, which gives you a more definitive impression of the speaker's emotion and intent. Or you might add an adverb to the dialogue tag for the same reason. Again, "I love you," she said casually, is clearer and less ambiguous than simply "I love you," she said. But if you have a piece of dialogue where the meaning itself is sharper and more definitive, you might not need the stronger verb or adverb at all. For example, "You're a clumsy idiot," said the coach, is probably clear enough without any extra emphasis, depending on what else is going on in the narrative. Another example, "You're a clumsy idiot," snarled the coach, seems to me to remain within the bounds of necessity, since it tells us something about the coach's vehemence and anger that we might not have gotten from the first example. However, "You're a clumsy idiot," said the coach disparagingly, is simply unnecessary. It's already clear from what the coach said that he's disparaging whomever he's talking to. We don't need the dialogue tag to tell us that the coach is being disparaging. We can hear it for ourselves. And the sentence, "You're a clumsy idiot," snarled the coach disparagingly, is just over the top. Any one of these examples, except maybe the last one, could still be permissible depending on the context. But you need to walk a fine line between leaving the dialogue too ambiguous on the one hand and over-explaining it on the other. When using dialogue tags, less is more. I'll say it again. You want the actual words the character is speaking to carry as much of the dialogue's meaning as possible. Now here's my final rule of thumb. The most graceful and evocative way to write dialogue is not to separate it out from the rest of the narrative, but to interweave it with the narrative as much as possible. In real life, people don't necessarily stop whatever else they're doing to talk to each other, but they carry on conversations while they're doing all sorts of things. And even if they do stop and concentrate on their conversation, each participant in that conversation is taking note of the other person's facial expression, gestures, and body language. Dialogue usually works best when it is an integral part of a scene that combines thoughts, actions, and the speech of your characters. To show you what I mean, here's a passage of dialogue from my novel Next, in which my main character Kevin, who is an academic editor, is having a meeting with Eileen, the professor who has just become his new boss. Kevin is trying to present the budget for the publication program he manages, while Eileen is standing behind her desk looking at carpet swatches for her new office. Here's the bare bones of the dialogue, just the direct quotations themselves, with the bare minimum of dialogue tags. "I've seen you at the gym," Eileen said. "Yes," Kevin said. "I assume that's your lunch hour?" "Yeah, I play a pickup game with some guys 2-3 days a week." "So the game itself lasts, what, 45 minutes? "Maybe a little less." "So by the time you walk over there, change your clothes, warm up, play the game, shower, and walk back to your office, that's what, an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half?" "Come on, Eileen, I see you at the gym all the time." "I'm not on the clock. May I call you Kevin?" "Of course." "Kevin, you're not salaried like I'm salaried. Do we understand each other?" "Perfectly." "I'll look over your budget, and we'll have a talk about it soon," said Eileen. Now, even with just the speech and nothing else, this is a reasonably clear passage of dialogue. It's obvious what's happening. Eileen is being imperious and condescending, and Kevin is being nervous and defensive. Even without any description of their actions or gestures or thoughts, it gets the point across. And even without being told anything else about them, you get a pretty vivid idea of what sort of people Kevin and Eileen are. Now, here's the scene as it appeared in the book. In this version, we have a bit more description of what Kevin and Eileen are actually doing as they speak. More importantly, because the novel is told entirely from Kevin's point of view, we have access to Kevin's thoughts. I'm also including a bit of the paragraph just before the exchange to show how the dialogue arises out of this particular situation. Eileen continued to stand and sort through swatches while Kevin delivered his little State of the Pubs program address, complete with a spreadsheet printed out that morning from Excel. "I've seen you at the gym," she said, still standing. "Yes, Kevin brightened. She remembers me. I assume that's your lunch hour?" Still, she wouldn't meet his eye, but instead glanced from a wine-red swatch in her left hand to a blue one in her right. "Yeah," he said casually, "I play a pickup game with some guys 2-3 days a week." "So," she said, laying down the blue swatch and picking up a bluer one, "the game itself lasts, what, 45 minutes? "Maybe a little less." "Uh-oh." "So by time you walk over there, change your clothes, warm up, play the game, shower, and sauna," thought Kevin, but he knew better than to say so. "And walk back to your office, that's what, 1.25 hours, 1.5 hours? Still, she wasn't looking at him. "Come on, Eileen," Kevin said collegially. "I see you at the gym all the time." "I'm not on the clock." She let both swatches fall from her hands in disgust and then said, with icy politesse, "May I call you Kevin?" "Of course." He could feel himself dwindling in the chair. "Kevin?" Eileen fixed him with glacially blue eyes. "You're not salaried like I'm salaried." His feet dangled above the carpet. His head shrank into his collar. "Do we understand each other?" Eileen said. "Perfectly," said Kevin, the incredible shrinking man. The meeting was over. "I'll look over your budget," she said, as he walked, vibrating with rage, across the crummy old carpet to the door. "And we'll have a talk about it soon." Now, the second version is not necessarily better than the first, but it does have the advantage of being more complete, more evocative, and more complex. The first version is shorter and sharper, but it doesn't give you any visual cues about the setting of the character. Even though you can infer each character's state of mind from what he or she says, you can't know it for sure. The first version leaves a lot for the reader to fill in. On the other hand, the second version integrates the dialogue with the setting, with the physical presence of Kevin and Eileen, and with Kevin's thoughts. Take their very first exchange, for example. In the first version, Eileen simply says, "I've seen you at the gym." And Kevin simply replies, "Yes." It's direct and clear, but it tells you very little about each character. It isn't until we get further into that version of the dialogue that we start to understand how it's going to go badly for Kevin. Now look at the second version again. "I've seen you at the gym," she said, still standing. "Yes," Kevin brightened. "She remembers me." The second version is only 5 words longer than the first version, but already we're getting very subtle, almost subliminal cues that this conversation won't end well. The fact that Eileen remains standing should be a warning sign for Kevin. Instead, he misreads her mood, and he brightens, thinking that she remembers him from the gym. This implies that he didn't expect her to remember seeing him there, and it further implies that he expects the fact that they both use the gym to be common ground between them. We don't get any of this from the first version, or at least we only get the barest hint of it. Then, as the second version progresses, we learn along the way, through some very simple details, that Eileen can be cold, at least with a subordinate. She speaks with icy politesse, and she looks at Kevin with glacially blue eyes. We can also infer that she has little respect for Kevin from the fact that she does not give him her full attention, but continues to sort through the carpet swatches while she talks to him. But this isn't just busy work in order to show the character doing something. These particular gestures act in counterpoint to her actual dialogue. They show her physically judging something as she starts to verbally judge Kevin, until, at the moment she lowers the boom on him, she lets both swatches fall from her hands in disgust. Her gesture reinforces her disapproval of Kevin's long lunch hours. And by the same token, we learn much more about Kevin in the second version. Since the novel is told from his point of view, we have access to his thoughts. And as the dialogue progresses, we don't have to infer his anxiety the way we do in the first version of the passage. Instead, we can actually see it happening in real time. We can hear his attempts to keep it light, such as when he speaks casually or collegially. We can see how his anxiety is expressed at first in little silent asides like, uh-oh, or he knew better than to say so. And finally, we see his anxiety expressed as comic hyperbole, such as when he starts to feel himself diminish under her gaze, becoming the incredible shrinking man. The dialogue and his silent internal monologue reinforce each other. His attempt to keep it light only heightens his anxiety, and his anxiety makes his excuses seem even more feeble. In the first version, with the dialogue alone, we are witnessing a conversation. But in the second version, we are participating in it, at least from Kevin's point of view. We feel how he starts to feel smaller under Eileen's icy gaze, and we feel him vibrating with repressed rage as he leaves her office. And that effect is the result of interweaving the dialogue with visual cues and physical sensations, and by giving the reader access to at least one of the character's thoughts. It would be easy to take the same exchange and write it from Eileen's point of view, showing us what Kevin looks like to her, cringing in his chair, and we'll talk more about that in the lectures about point of view. In my second lecture on dialogue, we'll be looking at examples from a wide variety of novels and stories, including David Copperfield, The Maltese Falcon, and Anna Karenina, as well as Toni Morrison's Beloved, Elmore Leonard's Cuba Libre, and Alice Munro's story, Walker Brothers Cowboy. In the meantime, here's an exercise you can use to help you think about writing dialogue and incorporating it into the rest of the narrative. It's very simple. Just write out a dialogue, say half a page or a page, between two people who are at cross purposes to each other. One is in love and the other isn't, for example, or one wants something that the other doesn't want to give up. In the first version, write it like a play, with no dialogue tags or even the names of the characters, just the dialogue itself. Then take that dialogue and start layering in more stuff. Do a version with basic dialogue tags, then a version with slightly more descriptive dialogue tags, then a version with a little bit of action and physical description, then a version with access to the character's thoughts, and so on. I think you'll find that each different version has a very different effect. Depending on what effect you prefer, you may find that the simplest version is the best, but you might find that one of the more complicated versions is. Which one you choose depends on what purpose the dialogue has in the larger narrative, and that is what I'm going to talk about in the next lecture.
Lecture 8. Integrating dialogue into a narrative.
In my first lecture about dialogue, I said that speech in fiction has to serve a purpose, no matter how rambling, digressive, elaborate, or colorful it is. I also said that, generally speaking, dialogue is used to evoke character, advance the story, and provide exposition. In this lecture, I want to talk in more detail about how you can use dialogue to serve those purposes, and I also want to talk about how you can find the balance between dialogue and the other parts of the narrative. Some stories and novels are made up almost entirely of dialogue, while some stories use it only as a seasoning, so to speak. Deciding just how much, how often, and how effectively your characters speak will also help you decide just what sort of story you're writing. Let's start with using dialogue to evoke character. As I said in my earlier lectures, character is usually evoked through a variety of techniques, all at once or in close succession. These include description, action, dialogue, interior monologue, and so on. While dialogue doesn't always bear the brunt of characterization, it's certainly not unusual for individual characters to talk in a distinctive way. Charles Dickens is especially known for his colorful secondary characters, who often use catchphrases or speak in a particular dialect. In David Copperfield, for example, there are a number of characters who are memorable for using repeated phrases or words. The oily Uriah Heep, who is one of the villains of the book, frequently mentions how humble he is. The perpetually debt-ridden Mr. Micawber is always counting on the fact that something will turn up. His loyal wife, Mrs. Micawber, who is forced to make do because of his financial ineptitude, constantly swears that she will never desert Micawber. George R. R. Martin, who has proven to be a sort of latter-day Dickens in the scope, variety, and detail of his many colorful characters, also uses this technique with the characters in his fantasy series, A Song of Ice and Fire. The noble Eddard Stark is always repeating the motto of his house, Winter is coming. And the wilding warrior Ygritte is always telling her lover, You know nothing, Jon Snow. And the members of the villainous Lannister family love to repeat their ominous slogan, A Lannister always pays his debts. It's more common, however, for a character to have a distinctive pattern of speech which makes him or her instantly recognizable, rather than an oft-repeated catchphrase. The aforementioned Mr. Micawber, for example, is especially distinguished by his comically elaborate way of expressing himself. It's probably the most memorable thing about him. Here he is, saying goodbye to his friends David Copperfield and Tommy Traddles, as he prepares to move his family to a new job in another city. "My dear Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber, rising with one of his thumbs in each of his waistcoat pockets, "the companion of my youth, if I may be allowed the expression, and my esteemed friend Traddles, if I may be permitted to call him so, will allow me, on the part of Mrs. Micawber, myself, and our offspring, to thank them in the warmest and most uncompromising terms for their good wishes. It may be expected that on the eve of a migration, which will consign us to a perfectly new existence," Mr. Micawber spoke as if they were going 500,000 miles, "I should offer a few valedictory remarks to two such friends as I see before me." Now, this goes on for another four paragraphs, and it's a lot of fun to read, but by modern standards, it does rather hit the same nail over and over again. A somewhat more modern example is the erudite and rather jolly criminal Casper Gutman from the Maltese Falcon. Gutman has something of Micawber's pomposity, but he is a much cleverer and more menacing man. Here he is, taking his leave of Sam Spade at the end of the book. "Now, sir, we will say goodbye to you unless..." The fat puffs around his eyes crinkled. "You care to undertake the Constantinople expedition with us? You don't? Well, sir, frankly, I'd like to have you along. You're a man to my liking, a man of many resources and nice judgment. Because we know you're a man of nice judgment, we know we can say goodbye with every assurance that you'll hold the details of our little enterprise in confidence. We know we can count on you to appreciate the fact that, as the situation now stands, any legal difficulties that come to us in connection with these last few days would likewise and equally come to you and the charming Miss O'Shaughnessy. You're too shrewd not to recognize that, sir, I'm sure." Now, this sort of speech works well in stories where the characters are a bit more extreme than they might be in a more realistic narrative. Micawber is a comic character in a Dickens melodrama, while Casper Gutman is a charismatic villain in a noir thriller. When creating more complex characters in less outrageous circumstances, you probably want to tone it down a bit. I want to say a few words here about using dialect in fiction. In the 19th century, lots of writers used it, with the result that a lot of 19th century fiction is now unreadable. In Dracula, for example, there's a long passage in which Bram Stoker tries to reproduce the accent of an old sailor from Yorkshire, and it's almost incomprehensible. Most readers just skip it. More controversially, dialect can come across as offensive or stereotypical. In Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain reproduced the African-American dialect of the runaway slave, Jim. 50 years later, Zora Neale Hurston had her African-American characters speak in dialect in her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Both Twain and Hurston were recreating patterns of speech they knew from personal experience. In Hurston's case, she was African-American herself, as well as an anthropologist and a folklorist who had done extensive field work across the American South and the Caribbean. But even these two great American writers have been criticized for perpetuating what some critics consider to be a racist stereotype. The problem with dialect is twofold. With its dropped G's, bristling apostrophes, and phonetic spellings, it's often hard to follow. The other problem is that unless the entire work is written in dialect, as Huckleberry Finn is, for example, using dialect while the rest of the narrative is in standard English can have the effect of setting its speakers apart as other and not normal. As a result, it's difficult for the reader to think of them as fully human. Today, most writers evoke dialect in a more subtle fashion. They rely on word choice and variations in grammar and syntax to suggest regional speech or social class, instead of trying to reproduce it in every detail. Consider Beloved the great novel by Toni Morrison about an African-American family coping with the aftermath of slavery in the years after the Civil War. The characters speak a straightforward, conversational, modern English. Now and then, they use just a bit of slang or non-standard syntax or grammar to suggest their race, social class, and the era. Here's a scene in which the main character, Setha, a pregnant slave who is making a run for her freedom, has gone into labor in a field of wild onions. She has just been discovered by a poor young white girl named Amy. Picking her way through the brush, Amy hollered back to Setha, "What you gonna do, just lay there and foal?" "I can't get up from here," said Setha. "What?" She stopped and turned to hear. "I said I can't get up." Amy drew her arm across her nose and came slowly back to where Setha lay. "It's a house back yonder," she said. "A house?" I passed it. Ain't no regular house with people in it, though. A lean-to, kinda." "How far?" "Make a difference, does it? You stay the night here, snake get you." "Well, he may as well come on. I can't stand up, let alone walk, and God help me, miss, I can't crawl." "Sure you can. Come on," said Amy. This is as close to dialect as Morrison gets in the book. She has Amy use a few slang expressions like gonna and kinda, and some non-standard usage like ain't, and some non-standard constructions like saying it's a house back yonder instead of there's a house back there. It suggests a time and place without the kind of slavish and often off-putting verisimilitude that Twain and Hurston deployed. What it loses in exactitude, it gains in immediacy and intimacy by giving us characters that any reader of any background can identify with. Another author who makes subtle and effective use of dialect is the Scottish mystery writer Denise Mina, whose novels are often set in working-class Glasgow. Instead of troweling on the Scottish dialect, she drops in the occasional turn of phrase or regional slang, using "I" for "yes," for example, or "bairn" for "child." In this way, she conveys a sense of place and of the economic status of each character without making them sound like Groundskeeper Willie from The Simpsons. As I said in my lectures about character, people in fiction generally have something at stake or something that they want. The best way to use dialogue to evoke character is to have them express what they want, though not necessarily directly. In other words, creating effective dialogue for a character involves inhabiting that character's point of view and not necessarily reproducing an accent or a particular pattern of speech. Reviews of fiction often talk about what a great ear a writer has. But creating a character's speech is less about reproducing a dialect or speech mannerism and more about thinking hard about who that character is, where she comes from, and how her speech might reflect her situation at a given moment. A terse character is going to talk in short bursts. An angry character is going to bluster or speak through clenched teeth. A nervous character is going to stammer or ramble on and on. A domineering character might not say much of anything at all, but keep her thoughts to herself, forcing everyone around her to fill in the silence. Or she might rage, overwhelming the people around her. Sometimes characters don't talk about what they want or about the situation they're in. Instead, they might talk about something tangential or even completely unrelated, and their style of speech serves to evoke both the speaker and the milieu. One of the masters of evoking character almost entirely through speech was the crime novelist and former Boston prosecutor George V. Higgins. Here's part of a monologue from the first chapter of his novel, The Friends of Eddie Coyle. In this excerpt, the title character, a small-time Boston criminal, is talking about the time two thugs broke his hand. "What made it hurt more," the stocky man said. "What made it hurt worse was knowing what they were going to do to you, you know? There you are, and they tell you very matter of fact that you made somebody mad. You made a big mistake, and now there's somebody doing time for it. And it isn't anything personal, you understand. It just has to be done. Now get your hand out there. You think about not doing it, you know? I was in Sunday school when I was a kid, and this nun says to me, 'Stick out your hand.' And the first few times I do it, she whacks me right across the knuckles with a steel-edged ruler. It was just like that. So one day I says, when she tells me, 'Put out your hand,' I say, 'No.' And she whaps me right across the face with that ruler. Same thing. Except these guys weren't mad. They aren't mad at you, you know? Guys you see all the time, maybe guys you didn't like, maybe guys you did, had some drinks with, maybe looked out for the girls. Hey, look, Paulie, nothing personal, you know? You made a mistake. The hand. I don't want to have to shoot you, you know? So you stick out the hand, and you get to put out the hand you want. I take the left because I'm right-handed, and I know what's going to happen, like I say. And they put your fingers in a drawer, and then one of them kicks it shut. You ever hear bones breaking? Just like a man snapping a shingle. Hurts like a bastard. In its own way, this is as beautiful as a Puccini aria. It's got rhythm, it's got music, and it tells a little self-contained story. Best of all, it gives you Eddie Coyle, his history, his world, in his own voice, in less than 300 words. It also intrigues the reader and prepares the way for the story to come. And that's a good segue to my next topic, using dialogue to tell the story. The Friends of Eddie Coyle tells a story about an armed robbery and its aftermath, mainly through a series of monologues and conversations. Some of these almost read like a play by Samuel Beckett, if Beckett had been an assistant U.S. attorney. The use of dialogue in crime narratives and detective stories is especially interesting, because a mystery often consists of two stories told in tandem with each other. One is the story of the investigation, which is usually chronological, and the other is the story of the events that led up to the crime. The second story is revealed to the reader in bits and pieces, not necessarily in chronological order. This backstory is often told entirely in dialogue, as the detective questions suspects or listens to long statements from witnesses. For example, large sections of the Sherlock Holmes stories are told through dialogue. Characters tell Holmes what they saw, heard, or did, and at the end, Holmes himself gives a long speech that reveals to Watson what actually happened. Another example is our old friend the Maltese Falcon. This novel is almost entirely made up of scenes in which the characters argue, plead, negotiate, and bully each other in offices, apartments, and hotel rooms around San Francisco. There are a few scenes of violent action, but most of the violence, in particular two shootings and a fire on a freighter, takes place off stage, so to speak. The most important elements of the plot involve what the characters say to each other as they fight for advantage, betray each other, and reveal their true natures, all in dialogue. But it isn't just crime fiction that uses dialogue to move the plot along. Another talky novel is Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Many of the most important encounters and incidents take place in conversation. During a scene at a ball in Chapter 18, the novel's proud heroine, Elizabeth Bennet, finds herself dancing against her will with the novel's haughty leading man, Mr. Darcy. And the two verbally spar with each other for three pages. It's too long to quote here, but it's one of the great romantic duels in literature, and it's one of the models for every scene since in which two lovers spend the first meeting loathing each other. Another one of the novel's most famous scenes is another verbal jousting match near the end of the book. This one is between Elizabeth and the imperious Lady Catherine de Bourgh, who tries to bully Elizabeth into giving up any hopes of marrying her nephew, Mr. Darcy. Again, it's too long to quote, but you can find it in Chapter 56 of Pride and Prejudice. It's one of the great smackdowns in literature, and it's conducted almost entirely in dialogue. But this is not to say that every conversation in fiction is a kind of competition or argument. As I said at the start, people in fiction speak to each other for all the reasons people in real life do. And people in fiction are just as capable of misdirection, confusion, and reticence as real people are. Some of the greatest scenes in literature feature characters who are not actually talking about what's at stake in the scene, but about something else entirely. Characters talk past each other. They lie. They manipulate. They are inarticulate. Sometimes they don't even realize what they're saying or not saying. Dialogue can hide a character's intent as well as show it. Often the meaning of a dialogue is more evident in what the characters don't say than in what they do. A wonderful example is from Part 6 of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina at the start of Chapter 5. In this scene, two minor characters, a middle-aged man named Sergei Ivanovich and a middle-aged woman named Varenka, are picking mushrooms in the forest. Each is in love with the other, and they both sort of know it. Not only is Sergei working up his nerve to ask for Varenka's hand in marriage, but Varenka is expecting him to propose at any moment. Here's the crucial moment where Tolstoy, in the godlike way of the great 19th century novelists, puts us inside both characters' heads simultaneously. And now it was to be decided. She was frightened. Frightened that he would speak and that he would not. He had to declare himself now or never. Sergei Ivanovich felt it too. Everything in Varenka's gaze, color, lowered eyes showed painful expectation. Sergei Ivanovich saw it and pitied her. He even felt that to say nothing now would be to insult her. In his mind, he quickly repeated all the arguments in favor of his decision. He also repeated to himself the words in which he wished to express his proposal. But instead of those words, by some unexpected consideration that occurred to him, he suddenly asked, "And what is the difference between a white boletus and a birch boletus?" Varenka's lips trembled as she answered, "There's hardly any difference in the caps, but in the feet." And as soon as these words were spoken, both he and she understood that the matter was ended, that what was to have been said would not be said, and their excitement, which had reached its highest point just before then, began to subside. "In the birch boletus, the foot resembles a two-day growth of beard on a dark-haired man," Sergei Ivanovich said calmly now. "Yes, that's true," Varenka replied, smiling, and the direction of their walk changed inadvertently. This is one of the most heartbreaking passages I have ever read. Two people coming this close to happiness and mutually losing their nerve. It's the kind of utterly human misunderstanding that has been played for laughs in countless romantic comedies. But Tolstoy allows the inherent tragedy at the heart of this exchange to come to full flower. The most heartbreaking feature of it is the fact that the dialogue in the scene has nothing to do with what's really on the characters' minds. They're thinking about love, but they're talking about mushrooms. And yet, even though the dialogue itself does not actually address the matter at hand or directly express any of the repressed emotion, this seemingly pointless dialogue is crucial to the devastating effect of the scene. In fact, the scene would not work without it. The intensity of their private emotions is juxtaposed on the page with their banal statements about mushrooms. Sergei Ivanovich agonizes for 88 words, pitying Varenka, worrying that he might insult her. In his head, at lightning speed, he reviews one more time all the reasons he should propose to her. Then, when the moment comes, he asks her a useless question about two different types of boletus mushroom. Varenka's lips tremble before she gives him an equally banal answer. They both know what's going on, but neither of them will say it aloud. The banality of their speech is the necessary counterpoint to the depth of their feelings. This counterpoint shows us that the one thing Varenka really wants to hear is the one thing Sergei Ivanovich can't bring himself to say. This oblique use of dialogue has become even more subtle in contemporary short fiction. Under the influence of the great short fiction writers of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, such as Anton Chekhov, James Joyce, and Catherine Mansfield, many contemporary short story writers often create powerful scenes in which the dialogue acts in counterpoint to what is actually going on. An expert practitioner of this technique is the great Nobel Prize-winning Canadian writer Alice Munro. In Walker Brothers Cowboy, the very first story of her first collection, Dance of the Happy Shades, she was already a master of the technique. The story is about a married salesman named Ben, who takes his two children with him one day into rural Ontario, where he stops at the house of a woman named Nora, whom he hasn't seen in years. The story is narrated in the present tense by Ben's daughter, but the voice is that of an adult looking back on a situation that she didn't understand at the time. The story is set in the 1930s, and near the end of it, Nora plays a phonograph record and makes the narrator, Ben's daughter, dance with her. As you listen to this excerpt, note how few dialogue tags Munro uses. "She whirls me around in front of my father, causing me to stumble, for I am by no means so swift a pupil as she pretends, and lets me go, breathless. Dance with me, Ben. I'm the world's worst dancer, Nora, and you know it. I certainly never thought so. You would now." She stands in front of him, arms hanging loose and hopeful, her breasts, which a moment ago embarrassed me with their warmth and bulk, rising and falling under her loose flowered dress, her face shining with the exercise and delight. "Ben." My father drops his head and says quietly, "Not me, Nora." This is almost as heartbreaking as the scene from Anna Karenina, but it has a more subtle effect than that scene did for a number of reasons. One reason is that Monroe only tells us what her narrator is thinking, unlike Tolstoy, who tells us exactly what both Sergei Ivanovich and Varenka are thinking. We have no direct access to the thoughts of Ben and Nora. We have to infer their emotions from what they say and do, and we can only guess, along with the narrator, what happened between them years ago. Monroe's narrator never comes right out and says, "This woman was an old flame of my father's, and now she wants him back." Instead, she allows us to experience the situation as the narrator did, picking up the cues from what she hears and observes, from the way Nora begs him to dance with her and the way he refuses, from the way her arms hang loose and hopeful and her face shines with delight, and from the way he drops his head and says, "Not me, Nora." Now, in The Maltese Falcon and Pride and Prejudice, the dialogue is more direct and instrumental, with the characters speaking directly to the matter at hand. And in Anna Karenina, Tolstoy makes the subtext explicit by telling us what the characters are thinking. But Alice Munro's dialogue is oblique. It carries a lot of emotion, but it stops just short of addressing the root cause of the emotion. Finally, the most mechanical use of dialogue is to provide exposition. This is the use of dialogue to have one character explain the backstory or impart some necessary information, ostensibly to another character, but in reality, to the reader. When it's done stylishly and evokes character at the same time, it can be a lot of fun. One expert practitioner of expository dialogue was the great American crime novelist Elmore Leonard. Sometimes Leonard also wrote westerns and historical fiction, and his novel Cuba Libre is about an American who gets caught up in the Spanish-American War in 1898. The first chapter of the novel provides an excellent example of using dialogue for exposition. In this chapter, two of the novel's major characters, a couple of cowboys who are planning to ship some horses to Cuba, sit with their feet up on the railing of a hotel in Texas and talk about their deal. During this conversation, they fill in their own backstories and, at the same time, provide the reader with a quick and dirty history of the war in Cuba. It goes on for several pages, but here's just a taste of it. Tyler said, "What about the war going on down there? It was in the paper the whole time I was at Yuma, the Cubans fighting for their independence. They were getting to it now." "It isn't like a real war," Charlie Burke said. "The two sides line up and shoot at each other. It's more like a hit and run. The Cuban insurgents blow up railroad tracks, raid the big estates, burn down sugar mills, and the Spanish army, the Dons, chase after them. You understand that's what gives us our market, replacing the stock they run off or kill. Once I'd made a few trips for a Texas outfit, ships cattle down there, it dawned on me, hell, I can run this kind of business. No time at all, I'm living in railroad hotels and drinking red wine with my supper." This is very economically and charmingly done. It tells us what we need to know about the politics of the situation they're getting themselves into, or at least enough to start with. At the same time, it still sounds like a couple of guys sitting around and talking. But even in this expertly written passage, we never quite lose sight of the fact that Elmore Leonard is sneaking a little history past us. It's painlessly done, and he introduces us to two important characters at the same time, but it's not as seamless or engrossing as the rest of the book. Even for a great writer like Elmore Leonard, working in the exposition can be tricky. We've all read books in which an especially flat minor character is wheeled on to explain the backstory and then wheeled off, never to be heard from again. Take the second chapter of Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles, for example. A character named Dr. Mortimer introduces the necessary background of the case by reading aloud from a couple of documents and then telling Holmes and Watson what he himself witnessed. Mortimer is thinly characterized as a practical-minded country doctor, but his main function in the story is to turn up from time to time and explain things. After delivering that backstory in the introductory chapter, Mortimer could disappear, and the book would be essentially the same without him. So instead of trying to shoehorn exposition into dialogue, I would suggest three alternate methods. The simplest way is just to flat-out violate the old show-don't-tell rule and provide the information directly to the reader in the narration itself. This is what I usually do. In two of my novels, The Lecturer's Tale and Kings of Infinite Space, I have a dramatic opening chapter or two to draw the reader into the story. Then I put the main narrative on hold while I fill in the background of the main character for a whole chapter. If your story is told in the first person, then that narrator is privy to the information you need to get across. You could have him or her do the same thing. Or, if the information absolutely has to come from a particular character at a particular moment in the story, you should consider using what's known as indirect dialogue, which is a summary of what a character has said without using his or her exact words. For example, you could distill Eddie Coyle's speech about getting his fingers broken into indirect dialogue, like this. Eddie explained that getting your fingers broken was like having the nuns slap your hand with a ruler back in Sunday school. They'd tell you to hold out your hand, and knowing what was going to happen only made the pain worse. The difference, Eddie said, was that the guys who broke your fingers weren't mad at you. They made you choose a hand and put your fingers in a drawer, then they'd kick the drawer shut. Eddie said it hurt like a bastard. Now, this doesn't have the poetry of the original, but it gets across the same information more quickly. In the next lecture, I'll be starting a block of 6 lectures about plot. In the introductory lecture, I'll be comparing 3 different types of plot, using as examples Joseph Conrad's novel Lord Jim, George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, and the Bruce Willis movie Die Hard. Meanwhile, here's another dialogue exercise. Without invading anybody's privacy, take a fragment of real-life conversation, one you may have been party to, or a brief exchange between 2 people you may have overheard in a public place, and try to construct a more lengthy and detailed dialogue out of it. It could be something as banal as one person asking, "Is this seat taken?" and the other replying, "No, it isn't." Or it could be freighted with significance, such as one person saying to another, "So what did you tell him?" and the other person saying, "I told him no." Whatever fragment you use, start by figuring out what the next line would be and try to spin as much out of it as you can, incorporating as many of the uses to which dialogue can be put as you can. In other words, starting with just 2 overheard lines, use dialogue to create a couple of characters and tell a little story. It may sound daunting, and it may be a bit tough to get started, depending on what 2 sentences you start with. But once you get going, I think you can have fun with it. The point of the exercise is to reinforce what I've been saying in these 2 lectures, namely that dialogue is not a separate beast from the rest of fiction writing, but an integral part of storytelling that can bear the weight of almost everything fiction can do.
Lecture 9. And then, turning a story into a plot.
In this first of 6 lectures about plot, I want to take as scripture something that my freshman English teacher at Big Rapids High School told me before I was 14 years old. Even at that age, I already knew that I wanted to be a writer. And my English teacher, Mrs. Nancy Giltner, saw at least enough promise in me to offer me the following insight and to trust that I would understand it. Literature, Mrs. Giltner said, is the creation of order out of chaos. It is the creation of meaning and structure out of a reality that is otherwise meaningless and without structure. Another way to put this insight is to say that real life does not happen in stories. It's true that our lives have beginnings, middles, and ends. But unlike a story, where the writer chooses which events are important and arranges them in a meaningful way, real life happens in a seamless, irresistible flow that does not break itself into discrete, well-rounded scenes. We do not speak in carefully crafted sentences. Our lives don't necessarily have clear conflicts. And our lives do not necessarily resolve neatly the way lives resolve in stories. We are carried from the birth canal to the grave in a relentless stream of experience surrounded by countless other people who are experiencing the same thing. While some of our experiences are more important than others, it's only because we choose to impose meaning upon them, often, in fact, by telling stories. Stories, in other words, are not natural. They are created in an arbitrary process through which the writer picks and chooses from a nearly infinite set of possibilities and makes something orderly and significant out of it. Stories are often what make our lives meaningful, bearable, and even joyful. But we impose stories on real life, not the other way around. At this point in these lectures, this should not be news to you. We've already looked at several ways that fiction imposes order on chaos. When we evoke a scene or a situation, we pick and choose the details that best get across what we want the reader to see and understand. When we create character, we pretend to get inside the heads of other people, and we pick and choose traits to